Welcome to the Changing Scripts podcast. Every Sunday, we'll have one of two types of episodes, all of them revolving around learning and using Mandarin Chinese. One type of episode will be my updates on what I'm learning, how I'm learning it, different quirks within the language, and sometimes information about China itself, since I am living in Shanghai, China right now. The second type of episode, where I'm interviewing people that are either learning the language like I am, or people who grew up with Mandarin Chinese and have learned other languages. These kinds of podcasts are passion projects. They're created from a place of deep interest, and they need to find other people that have those interests. And the best way to do that is word of mouth. So you can go fill out an Apple Podcast review if you really want to, but honestly, I'd much rather you tell a few of your friends about this podcast. Thank you. This week on the Changing Scripts podcast, we're going to get the viewpoint of Wo Weiwei, her English name Liz, who is a native Mandarin Chinese speaker. She grew up with both Putonghua and Shanghaiese, and then she learned English, and actually she was reading science fiction in English when she was already 14 years old. She is now a simultaneous interpreter, and we'll talk about what that entails in this interview. Liz's viewpoint on how she learned both Chinese as well as Shanghaiese and English are really, really fascinating. Because Liz is an interpreter, she dives into different layers of differences in languages than we've talked about necessarily. She dives into trying to get the personality characteristics of the speaker in the interpretation that she's doing for her work. We talk about books because she's a book lover, what language she dreams in, different movies and stories that come up in both languages, and Liz, just so you know, is a natural storyteller. So there are going to be moments where you're going to want to sit back with whatever beverage in whatever comfy chair you are and just absorb her gifted storytelling abilities. Without further ado, here is Liz.
Thank you so much, Liz, for joining us today on Changing Scripts podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
Can you quickly introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hi, my English name is Elizabeth, and my Chinese name is Wo Weiwei. Wo is the surname. It literally means fertilizer land, which is very rare in a Chinese surname system. And Weiwei means the rose that survives. So I'm really happy that my parents named me in this way.
That's beautiful. What should I call you today?
Whichever you please. Liz, Lizzie.
We usually start with your language background and then we move into languages learned later on. Let's dig into your first language. What was your first language that you learned?
Mandarin is my mother tongue. I'm a Chinese and I was born and raised in Shanghai. I have a very good competency in Shanghai dialect, but not as well as Mandarin. Mandarin mm-hmm. is the language I was taught, mm-hmm. spoken in school, and at home.
Okay. Do you have any memories of learning the language, either speaking, writing, reading, any part of it?
I'd like to think that my mom's wise, so I was taught by, I think from age 3 to age 5, mm-hmm. I was taught 10 characters per day by my mom. And I used to practice 2 hours a day just writing these characters while my mom taught me mm-hmm. what it meant. And the funny thing is my mom actually taught me the wrong characters for ups and downs. So throughout the entire elementary school, I confused up and downs mm-hmm. all the time in writing Chinese characters. But I'm very fortunate to have my mom teaching me these mm-hmm. characters. When at the age maybe around 4, that mm-hmm. was the best time to memorize, to learn language.
Absolutely. Now 10 a day sounds like quite a bit.
It sounds like a lot, but it did not feel like a chore when I was little. I just saw that, I was drawing this little painting and little pictures. Mm-hmm. That's what I saw.
I have to ask you about how you did it. Because I have flashcards behind you. They're really awkward and horrible, and I'm sure they don't look like the words they're supposed to. But I write them in pencil because every now and then I realize how horrible they are, and I erase it and I redo it. But I've been told that the Hanzi characters look very different if they're written in pen versus pencil. So what did you use when you were practicing?
I think I started with pencil, mm-hmm. and it's also recommended somehow that the pencil has a softer touch because the tip is made of carbon, so it offers a softer touch.
Okay.
It's easier to write on.
See, I think so too.
Yeah. when you have a ballpen tip or you have one of those fountain pens, mm-hmm. then the strokes requires more strength or power mm-hmm. to write them, mm-hmm. so the character comes out a little bit different.
Right. Yeah. And how many times did you write each one?
They always say that a character, you have to write it, literally use it for more than 20 times. Mm. But I think the more the better, because somehow that you're not only writing a picture, there is some heritage, some cultural heritage behind it, because Chinese character is evolved not from letters but from small pictures that used to write on the walls. Mm-hmm. Now we study simplified Chinese character because this is simplified for the Chinese government to eliminate illiteracy in China, and that's a necessary move. But the more complicated traditional characters are the real Chinese Mandarin characters that evolved from pictures.
Yep.
It literally tells a story.
Some people, when they're a child, they really start to like to read, or they really like to talk, whether it's to their stuffed animals or to their family members.
Right, right.
Some people lean towards a specific language skill that they really like. Did you have one of those that you really like to do?
I wasn't much for speaking, that's for sure, because I was very shy and timid. Mm. And I had a bit of a stutter. So that further made speaking to other people a little bit off-putting. So I was more about doer. I was very much into reading, and I never liked fiction. Facts and science is always my thing. Mm-hmm. But I loved science fiction from 8 to now, non-stop.
Yeah, you're still reading it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've read all the classics. Some, when I was capable, sci-fi novels, I read them almost exclusively in English.
Yeah. What? As a kid? As a child?
Since age 14.
I've been told that in Mandarin there is a lot of science fiction being written.
Yeah.
Did you have a favorite science fiction book or series in either or both languages?
I read science fiction both in Mandarin and English, and somehow that, I'm not saying all of them are, but science fiction, I think, has been fostered and developed longer in Western countries than it is in China. And then somehow some of these classic authors, their capabilities and their commendable words for language goes beyond just imagination.
Mm-hmm.
They connect really well with the audience, the readers, and they manipulate how they think and feel really well in a way that I truly appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at in the past 30 years, it's probably when the Chinese science fiction started to develop, and most of them has a bit of a undertone of this male chauvinist in there that makes me a little uncomfortable. Even with the very
Wait,
famous,
isn't
like
that
the three body
English
one.
Fiction? Yes.
That was the part one is okay, but the part two and part three, the way that it's written in Mandarin, which is its mother tongue, by Liu Cixin, was
no.
Which is not good.
But doesn't English science fiction kind of have that tinge to it too?
Not really, no. It's so diversified that you can't really grasp. Even with one writer like Neil Gaiman or with either the three giants, you can see that each book, there are nuances, differences that makes it unique.
Neil Gaiman did American Gods, right?
Yes.
That has a massive male chauvinistic side to
it,
doesn't
absolutely,
it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I couldn't actually finish that one for that very reason.
It's a little annoying to read.
Yeah.
But if you go beyond it and you see the world that he constructed, it was quite amazing.
Exactly. Yeah, I want to push through it again because my husband just read it the whole way through, and he kept telling me parts of it, and I'm like, I wanted to get to the mythological part, and I kept getting stuck on the guy-ness of the main character, and I was like, I need to get past that.
Yeah.
Have you watched the TV show?
Not yet.
No.
I think I maybe watched one or two episodes, but that's it. It's a little bit not faithful to the...
Ah, well then never mind. I don't want to... It doesn't have to be, but I think for that one, I want it to invite me back into the book, and I don't think it would do that if it's that.
No, probably not.
So do you remember your first trip to the library?
There is no library in my elementary school, junior and senior. So the first trip that I ever made to the library was, I think, the second day that I enrolled in the university, Fudan University. And because library was a place I've never visited, so I went there and I was absolutely this wow effect because it was so many books. It was the first time I've seen so many books in one room.
I haven't been inside Fudan University's library. I can only imagine how big it is.
It had this really old yet kind of, I would say approachable maybe is the way. It feels close to me, but at the same time it feels distant because there are science building where it's full of these books that nobody reads and collect the dusts, right? But literacy is something I would love, so that would be awesome.
I embarrassingly follow some book Instagram feeds and different kind of social media feeds, and people will literally post pictures of libraries and bookstores. I like libraries and bookstores, but I really just want to read the books.
Right.
But I'm so addicted to watching. Like, there'll be pictures, and I'll just kind of stare at it. Mm. And in my brain, I'm going into that library, and I'm going to sit right there, and I'm going to read that book from over there. And then this whole story kind of just creates itself, and I'm like,
that's awesome.
What just happened? It's amazing how different libraries look differently and feel like they'd be comfortable to read this kind of thing or that kind of thing.
Yeah, there's a character to each one of them.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite library in Shanghai?
I do go to Shanghai Library often, but to be honest, it's a little disappointing for the fact that you need to have a reference deposit, which is 1,000, to be able to borrow any of the books in English which was was published in the near 5 years.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are tool books that I don't really need.
Yeah.
But for any literacy, they have very few copy of it. Like, I have a book list on my phone. People recommend good books to me that they feel that they've learned a lot about this book from these books. And I have this list. Once in a while, I would go to the library and then search through their system. Or also, I can do that on a WeChat public account of Shanghai Library. But often, these books are not available, or there is some kind of error with the numbers that they can't be found. So I would say the hit rate is about 2 out of 5. If I get 2 out of 5, I'd consider myself lucky. So that's the one way that I start to buy books.
Yeah.
Try to buy e-books instead of going there, because going there is like a half-day trip or something, right?
And it's pretty packed a lot of times. It's hard to find a seat if you want to actually sit and read there, too.
Oh, it's impossible unless you go there super early, as soon as they open.
Yeah,
the best sunlight was at the
top floor.
Yeah, the first floor where the newspapers are, but there is no wall socket, so. Yeah.
It's so hard.
Yeah, that happened.
Have you been to the library? There's one in Pudong, not close to the metro. That's all I remember. I think we ended up walking for like 20 minutes from metro station in Pudong to this gigantic library.
I don't believe I've been there. I would love to.
No, it is beautiful, but each floor has different starting and opening and closing hours. And where we sat down was this beautiful area with like those kind of shared desks right near windows, and it was very quiet, and there were lots
of
books.
That.
It was beautiful, but we got there about 10 minutes before it closed because we were reading the signs of the floor we came in on, not the floor we sat down on.
Right.
It was very confusing. So each floor had different times. But I think if you get there early enough, that's not going to be an issue.
It's the same with Shanghai Library. Shanghai Library.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, each floor. I think from the second or the fourth floor, it has a different closing. It opens at the same time,
yeah,
but it has a different closing time.
That is slightly confusing. I would look it up for you. It's a beautiful building, and I keep meaning to go back, but the difference, well, it being so far from the metro, and the closing times being, I could probably read the times now, but at the time we were still fairly new to Shanghai this time around, and so we were just staring at the signs going, let's just sit down and see what happens. And that's what happened. We sat down for 10 minutes and we're like, we have to go now.
Oh, but that's awesome. At least
it is beautiful. And they have a lot of English books and a lot of, obviously, other books.
Oh,
many
wow,
different,
so good.
Many, many different subjects. They have a lot of science stuff, a lot of history stuff, a lot of stuff. I don't know if you can check them out.
I probably can, because I just realized that I have this membership card from Shanghai Library, which is connected, meaning that I could actually borrow books from the library that's closest to me, which is Jing'an Library.
There you go. Wait, there's a library in Jing'an?
Shanghai Library is an entire library system.
Yeah.
So it has one branch in almost each district in Shanghai, and also that does not include private libraries and collectors.
Okay.
So, yes, the closest to me is the one on Xingjia Road, and it's Jing'an Library.
Very cool.
They have a much smaller collection,
right,
but you can actually borrow and return books.
Perfect.
There, so
yeah,
you don't have to go all the way.
So they're just different
Shanghai
branches
Library
at the same. And at home, you said your mom was teaching you the characters. Was Pudonghua spoken at home, or were there any other dialects spoken at home?
My mother's from Sichuan province, where they speak Sichuan dialect. And then she taught me Mandarin in Sichuan. So I speak fluent Shanghai dialect, Mandarin, and Sichuan dialect.
How different are those three?
I'd say that in the eyes of a foreigner, these are three different languages. Shanghai dialect, I don't really know.
But for you, how different do they feel?
I know that Shanghai dialect is very, very different from Mandarin. It's not a written language. And it has so many slangs that's translated. I think it's closer to Japanese than it is to Mandarin. Even people as close as Nanjing, they don't understand a word of Shanghai dialect. You can literally say nasty words to people from Nanjing right in front of them.
Why would we do that? No, I'm kidding. I'm sorry.
I actually did that as a prank in school. And I still feel bad about it.
Did they ever realize what was happening?
No.
Okay, nothing. That's good, that's good. Then you don't need to feel bad. But I've heard that. Is it just the sound of the language that is similar to Japanese?
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like if a friend of mine and I were going to outer provinces and we speak Shanghai dialect, often we're mistaken for Japanese tourists.
I have heard that a few times. Yeah, I interviewed a young lady recently who was from Songjiang.
Right.
And she was saying that that happens to her all the time when she's in a store in Shanghai, out of Shanghai, even when she was up in Qingdao one day, people were like started talking to her in Japanese or even Korean sometimes. And
very easily.
Yeah.
It sounds close to Japanese.
Okay. I still can't hear the difference between Putonghua and Shanghaiese, but I'm hoping someday it's going to come.
It will come to you. Has a quite large difference because Shanghai dialect is very lippy. Mm-hmm. Lippy movements, or most of the pronunciations were done between the T's and the lips.
Okay.
So it goes much, much faster than Mandarin. It can go really, really much faster.
So it's more the front
Mandarin.
Of the mouth, whereas more than the back? That.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Right now I'm catching like a word or a phrase here and there. I think once I can understand full sentences, I'll be like, oh, okay, now I can hear the difference. But it's a long process. There are people from so many different parts of the country here.
Right.
That just when I think I have the sound of a word or phrase down, I'll hear it a lot of different ways.
Well, it's not a language you can easily obtain no matter how long you live here. It's not a language that you can you can speak easily unless you are emerged into that.
So the script is part of the reason that pulled me into learning Mandarin Chinese this time, because it's beautiful and it's mysterious, at least simplified is, because it's kind of hiding part of the meaning.
Right.
The strokes are like meditative.
Absolutely. Kind of.
But I've noticed when I talk to people about this, people tend to use character when they mean word. And I know that there are radicals, there's strokes, there are elements, there are radicals, there are words that are phrases, sentences, and so on. And that characters can be words, and words consist of characters. But here's the question. To somebody coming into the language new, somebody just arriving to China or just starting to learn Mandarin Chinese, how would you describe the difference between a character and a word in Chinese?
A word could often be consist of more than one character, and a character is just a character.
Mm-hmm.
And the character can be further dissembled into different parts.
Mm-hmm.
Often that there are structures such as left and right, top, bottom, top, mid, bottom, and outside and inside. And these are the basic, I would say, framework of a Chinese character, which is often evolved from a picture. That's why most of a Chinese character can be written in literally like a square.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's where the beginners learn characters
and
the words. The difference is Chinese characters, often you could use it as a Lego block, and the Chinese character is a Lego block that comes with its own meanings, but its meaning changes when it's combined with other characters to form words, and that's what truly makes Chinese Mandarin as a language makes it difficult to learn, because not only that you have to learn the meaning of the words, which could come in 10 or 20 different meanings, but when it combined with other words to other characters to form words, and then it has a very specific, very identified meaning, and it sometimes changes in different contexts, but the meaning is there. So that's the difference between Chinese character and words.
When children are learning the language in school, like in primary school, is there talk about syllable versus word? Each character is basically a syllable, right?
Yeah, you could use that as such a metaphor.
Like, how is the language talked about? Like, do you talk much about words and sentences and that kinds of things when it's talked about?
And somehow that for a country that has so many thousands of years, debatable, 7 or 5,000 years, debatable.
Sure.
But our way of the Mandarin being taught is very primitive. meaning that, okay, many Chinese children at age of three can already form sentences. Also, they can't write, they can't read, right? Sure. But they can already talk in that language somehow in communication with their whoever. Mm-hmm. And then when they go to school, often that our Mandarin textbook is consist of, I think one book has maybe 18 to 20 texts, and they're often dialogues or perhaps a section of some books, some articles, and then you pick out the words that you don't understand, and you give them a pinyin. And pinyin is the, I would say that instructions or pronunciation of a specific word, but it has no meaning whatsoever. And the pinyin did not come originally with the words. It was invented afterwards.
Like the 1950s, 1960s, exactly. Yeah.
Because back then, most people, they speak Mandarin, but they don't read and write or illiterate.
Right,
so
right.
Pinyin was an invention, which makes it even harder to learn Mandarin, because the word and the character, the pronunciation and the character has no direct correlation to it whatsoever. But there are some meaning to it if you recognize the words. And often if there is a word that you don't recognize or haven't learned before, you can sort of guess the pronunciation.
The sound components.
There are bases to how the pronunciation came to be.
Yeah.
So we do practice in Mandarin learning. We do learn new characters.
Yeah.
At class, we were taught the pronunciation of it, and we do have to go home and write it 20, 50 times. And one of the major exercises we have to do is write essays and articles. It's the best way to practice it.
It really is. This doesn't sound primitive. This sounds good. Because let me tell you, because in English, just after I finished primary school, like the generation after me, they stopped explicitly learning grammar. Like, I learned grammar. I underlined things. I circled things. We got into grammar identification when I was at elementary school. And then it stopped in the U.S. And I don't know what they do now. But honestly, when I was doing that, I was so bored.
It is boring.
I feel like if I would have been within a story or a dialogue, it would have had more meaning and it would have stuck better than just going, this is a noun, this is a verb, this is an adjective.
Oh, that's kind of boring.
Right? Yeah. So I feel like within stories and dialogues might be more interesting to learn language.
Well, we kind of have to learn that in that way, because the Chinese character itself bears meaning. And if you're just memorizing it, it's extremely confusing. So there are some really interesting mistakes made.
Oh, example time. For example.
I think there are some screenshot in a group that was posted. And it was this elementary schools making mistakes in misused characters because they share the same pronunciation.
Oh, right.
That's the most common one.
Yeah.
And I can't remember anything specific, but I just remember laughing really badly when I read them. It was... And language is also in a way that it sort of reveals the thinking pattern or the way that one thinks. The usage of language or the choice of words and tonalities are very specific to individuals.
Yeah, so true.
If you're enjoying this conversation about the Chinese language and would like to participate, if you're studying the Chinese language or if you come from the Chinese language and have learned other languages, both perspectives are greatly appreciated on this channel. Let's have a conversation. Let's tape that sucker and let's get it into this podcast. Contact me and let's etch out the details on how to get you and your valuable language learning experience onto this podcast. All of my information is in the show notes. Also, all over social media except Facebook, I am Steph Puccio, STEPHFUCCIO. That includes Gmail for my email, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, and LinkedIn. So I look forward to hearing from you.
You were reading science fiction at 14, so I'm assuming you started learning English pretty early on. When did you start?
Not voluntarily. My parents thought that English would be, even in English classes, would be a very good way to get rid of me. So from the fourth grade in elementary school, which compared to now is already pretty late, because now the kids start to learn it in kindergarten, right?
What is fourth grade? Is that like 10, 11 years old?
Yeah, okay. It's really, really late.
10 years old, okay.
So I have about three nights a week that I would take take English classes. Actually, it's I think it's a new concept, right? New concept. That's the whole like systematic learning with each book contains 144 classes, lessons. And did that for a couple of years, learned nothing.
What? Okay.
Because I was just not interested.
Okay.
So I don't understand it. Yeah. And these are the scribbles, these letters. I didn't get it.
Oh. Can we talk about the classroom for a second? Like, sure. How many kids were in the classroom with you?
To be honest, most of my classmates were there. I had, I think, 42, maybe 43.
What?
Class in the elementary school, just one class is that size.
In the night school?
And at night school, yeah, it's yeah, at okay. least two-thirds of it.
Oh, my god!
At least two-thirds of it.
That's a big language class for a night school, isn't it?
No, there are like 7 or 8 of them every night.
What? Oh, my god!
I only took English classes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then there are, like, math, mm-hmm. physics,
oh, sure,
and everything.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I started teaching at one of those, but in Taiwan. Like, 6 to 9 at night was when I taught. Yeah, 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 yeah. But ours was a little bit different, because I had a North American boss and his Taiwanese wife, and the classrooms were very small. I think it was anywhere from like 15 to 20 students.
That's much better.
Yeah, yeah, 40's a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Was it just the teacher lecturing, or did you guys actually use the language? Like, did you practice in class?
There was no time to practice. These classes make me feel like they're pushing a dead horse forward, like dragging them through the story. I'm the dead horse and they're dragging
oh, no.
me, but I'm receiving nothing. For me, it's just really, really boring to sit in a class listening to stuff that I know nothing about for 3 hours a night. You know, I would have to use that time elsewhere.
Okay, but you clearly learned the language to a high degree, so how did you get here?
I used to, of course, when I was in elementary school, I'm reading Mandarin, and my most interested subjects was classic literacy and both Chinese and foreign classic literacy and science fiction as well as science. So I used to ask so many questions that drive my parents crazy. Because they can't answer any of them.
Yeah, okay.
And I have always been a very inquisitive, very curious person. And now that I look back, I'm so grateful that my parents did not impose any restrictions on me just because I was a girl. Because I realize lots of girls of my age, they're enclosed in a way. And so my favorite story at that time, what I've read 20 times minimum, was this little tiny, tiny book. It was so small. It was like a half size of a palm. And there was a simplified version of a Dumas classic, which is Monte Cristo. And it was, it was like, it made it so simple read for elementary students. I read so many times, and once I thought, I would really love to read the full volume of it when I was in high school.
But, so what was it about that story? That
it was, at the surface, it sounds like a revenge of a man that's been wronged and become a victim of various political and material gang and all these games, right, in this very little town that he was meant to be happy, and then he was wrong. He was imprisoned. He was enlightened in prison. He escaped, inherited fortune, and then come back for like a proper hero comeback style, right? But no, it's a love story. It's absolutely a love story.
Whoa, okay.
Because after he came back,
yeah,
he found the love of his life.
Oh.
That, no, he was the love of his life. And on his wedding night, he was sent to prison. Oh, yeah.
No.
That story was so good. It was so gripping. Oh, it was absolutely amazing.
And how old were you when you got your hands on that story?
Oh, I was really young. 7, maybe 8.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I started reading the Chinese version of it, because that's my favorite story. So I went back to read it, and that wasn't enough. I asked my parents to buy me the full book of it. And somehow they just didn't. I don't know. Maybe they weren't interested, or they think I spent too much money on books or whatever. But I didn't get the real version until I was in senior high school.
Like 15, 16-ish?
So, yes.
Okay.
So prior to that, I've only read everything in Mandarin.
Yeah.
I didn't read anything in English.
Yeah.
But that was the first book. But I couldn't find a Chinese version of it.
Yeah.
And then I knew that it was written in French.
Yeah.
And then later translated into English.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know that back then. I thought it was written in English. Mm-hmm. I thought that, why do I have, if I'm capable if I have time and effort, mm-hmm. and I can, my English was okay at that time. Mm-hmm. Was actually not okay. It was pretty bad. But if I could have the full course meal mm-hmm. in its original, you know, state, mm-hmm. why do I need somebody else to chew it up for me? Mm-hmm. So I started reading it in English, and the only thing on each page that at least 30 or 40 words, vocabulary, mm-hmm. that I have to consult to dictionary, and whoa. I did not
yeah.
have an electronic dictionary
yeah.
whatsoever back
yeah.
then.
Yeah, yeah.
You literally have to flip through pages, oh, and that's what I did.
Yeah, yeah.
And the only reason I did it, go through all the trouble, is because the story is amazing!
The power of story.
Absolutely.
I love that. That's beautiful.
Absolutely. It still even it remains today. Mm. And that it just started this, I would say, this flood mm-hmm. that cannot be stopped. This absolutely unstoppable force.
Yeah. Wow.
And I've been reading English.
Yeah.
Reading English since then.
Yeah.
To be honest, my English is a lot better than my Mandarin.
Well, there's always a price to pay, right? You have to.
I think so.
Use. Yeah, what did we say? In the 80s in the US, we had this thing for, like, there was, like, a fitness craze, and they were like, if you don't use it, you lose it. Same thing with languages.
Oh, yeah, that's so true.
If you don't practice it, even if it's one you grew up with, it gets weaker.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's true, actually. And that's how the words evolves and sort of, like, individualized mm-hmm. or personalized. You can so easily identify them now. And part of my job that I really enjoy is that every speaker has a distinctive character. Mm. It's like fingerprint, never duplicated. And there are some speakers yeah. are just so charismatic.
Yeah.
You literally got sucked into mm-hmm. their little universe and mm-hmm. you don't want to leave. Voluntarily, like, I stay here forever. I can listen to this person speak forever.
It's like audio art or something.
Absolutely.
That's beautiful.
Absolutely. And oh then there gosh. Are some speakers, you're like, after 30 seconds, I want to go. Please, I'll pay you to go.
And this makes sense. I listen to a ridiculous amount of podcasts. I think I say that a lot of time on the podcast. And there are some podcasts that are about subjects that I don't care about, but the person who is running it, even if it's a group of people talking, the person who's running it is so interesting and has such a strong personality, or they use some really juicy vocabulary that I haven't heard in a while, and I'm like, oh, I like you.
Oh,
you're going to make me use a dictionary in my first language. Yeah, let's go. And so I'll listen to, like, things on finance and kind of like a philosophy one I'm starting to listen to, and I think that his personality through his voice is so beautiful, and the way he expresses himself, I'm just like, oh, that pause, that word, that sentence. Yeah, it's like what you're talking about. It's just like, what is that thing that they're doing?
And there, I could give you an example in this, that often when people get on stage, mm-hmm. they have a specific purpose, an agenda, mm-hmm. a message that they must get across. Mm-hmm. So the audience, after a whole day of conference, mm-hmm. are getting pretty tired and a little anxious because they're looking forward to the content that mm-hmm. they're looking for something mm-hmm. and that they're there for a purpose. And then after a whole day of conference, mm-hmm. The last speaker mm-hmm. of the day went onto the stage very slowly. Mm-hmm. This is very small, this 92-year-old man mm-hmm. who is the founder of either, I think it was a conference in financial investment or some kind of high-end mm-hmm. tech stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went on to the stage, and his speech time is supposed to be 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke so slowly
mm-hmm.
that I could feel, even in the SI booth, mm-hmm. Simultaneous interpreter booth,
mm-hmm.
I could feel that the audience are getting a little unsettled.
Mm-hmm.
They are impatient. They expect the master or the founder of a specific industry to give them some hacks or tricks or cheats that can make advance their own agenda, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this little old man slowly walked onto the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as an interpreter, I had to prepare for everything, a 20-minute
mm-hmm.
20-minute speech,
mm-hmm.
7 pages of PPT, the shortest I've ever encountered.
Huh.
And there is no words, only pictures.
Yes!
I know. I was like, oh, I don't have to prepare anything.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also antagonizing because mm-hmm. often based on my experience, if you only have pictures, it means you're going to say a lot of stuff that's not there. that I cannot prepare for.
Right.
So when he walked onto the stage, often people that are the founder of something, they have a lot to say.
Mm-hmm.
But this beautiful 92-year-old man,
mm-hmm.
you can feel that life is slowly leaving him,
mm-hmm.
but he's still there,
mm-hmm.
and was this full spirit.
Yeah.
And he spoke slowly. He's the slowest speaker I have ever encountered. He literally come up with about 23 to 25 words per minute.
How much do people usually do?
Minimum 150. To listen to his speech at first few couple minutes, mm-hmm. literally the audience has to get used to such a slow pace.
Yeah.
But the upside to it is mm-hmm. that you calm down and you start to truly listen.
Mm-hmm.
7 pages,
mm-hmm.
7 stories.
Whoa.
7 pages, 7 stories. Nothing to do with the finance, the field that he's in.
Right.
But each equally captivating.
Wow.
And the whole audience went quiet. And now
mm-hmm.
I'm talking about a conference that
mm-hmm.
housed more than 800 audience. Not a beat. Nobody left
yeah.
mm-hmm. in that period of 20 minutes time
mm-hmm.
to take a call. Nothing. It was silence. It was the most quiet room I've ever been in. I don't even remember, but I enjoyed
mm-hmm.
literally, because as a SI, I'm accustomed to fast thinking. That's what I'm trained for.
Simultaneous interpreter. SI.
Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
And then I have to think really fast. I have to work for it really
mm-hmm.
fast. I have to do so many things, multitasking at the same time, that
mm-hmm.
I'm constantly on adrenaline high.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only way you can do it.
Sure.
But when he comes onto the stage, everything calms down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just this state, this serene state that I'm in, that I just feel so privileged that I got to translate for the speech, because we alternate every 15 and 20 minutes.
Right.
So it could have just easily been my partner.
Right.
And all of us just listen to the stories. The stories is somehow loosely related to the field,
mm-hmm.
but it's all the anecdote that you never ever hear or see from
yeah.
anyone else, that only he knows.
Wow.
It makes me feel like we're truly getting insight
mm-hmm.
of the history of that entire industry, how it came to be,
mm-hmm.
who did what,
mm-hmm.
and you never hear the story anywhere else, and that's the true treasure.
That's beautiful. So when he was done, what was people's reaction?
It was silent for a minute.
Yeah.
Because people are still waiting for him to come up with like the next one. Because
right.
he didn't usually conclude, this is my speech,
mm-hmm.
thank you. This is basically a cue to applaud, right?
Right, right?
But no, he didn't. He just stood there. He didn't say anything. And just stood on the stage.
Mm.
And it took the audience a while to respond to it. And then it was just this ocean, this thunder of claps. And then
yeah.
he just walked slowly. Literally, people stood up,
mm.
clapped, and watched him walking down the stage.
That's amazing.
Nobody wanted him to leave.
Right.
And it was so amazing. It was
wow.
not the most brilliant speech, but definitely I can feel that there is a connection, and this is the power of words.
See,
it doesn't...
I feel the need to do this comparison with what you said with the horse in the classroom. With this captivating...
Absolutely
captivating speech. Across the board... In any country, in most countries, most, not all, nothing's all, this is what happens in the language classroom. And part of me is trying to figure out why and how we can change it, or how we can change it outside of the classroom. Like, why does the language classroom turn into that excruciating experience? Instead of the beauty of words, like this gentleman captivating 800 people, because that's what language is. That's what drew me into language and reading. And yeah, stories. And people and personalities and experience and...
The way that it was told.
Yeah.
Makes a huge difference.
Huge difference. How do we find that middle ground, or just inject that beauty into those classrooms instead of the...
I think most people are interested in storytelling
mm-hmm.
way of learning, right? And
yeah.
we always learn different things from the same story.
Mm-hmm.
And then for me, that some of the stories, they have a lot of conflict,
mm-hmm.
but this kind of Hollywood-style sort of force-fed storytelling
yeah.
line, its plot is really getting old. Because
yeah.
Language, after all, is the fruit of thoughts.
Yeah.
So the more you think about it, the better you can express yourself. So
definitely.
Often then you make a lot less mistake.
Mm-hmm.
in writing than you would in talking. In writing, you feel this, whether it's the emotions embedded or the meaning is somewhat filtered and it's more pure, and it's easier to come up with the beauty, to find or even to create beauty in writing. But in speech, it's a lot harder to do.
It is a lot harder to do.
Yeah.
A lot. And you can, your edits in writing are generally a lot more invisible. But you have to fix your speech. It's unless you're doing what we're doing now, where I can literally delete, re-record, and do whatever. In when it's in real life, it's really your mistakes are audible. You have to go backwards and say, "Oh, sorry, I meant this," or "Oh no, how did that come out of my mouth?" it's much harder to do that before.
Yeah,
it exists in the world. Okay, so other languages. So we've got Mandarin Chinese and the Shanghaiese and Sichuan dialect. Okay, did you learn anything after English? Any other languages?
Well, I am required to learn German.
Oh.
And pass exams in about a year and a half because I'm studying and I'm trying to acquire a BA from the Shanghai Foreign Language Institute. So the second foreign language is required.
Okay.
And the choice at the time was German and Japanese. So I would prefer German because it's closer to English, which I know it's wrong, but I presume at that time that it would be a little bit easier for me.
I have heard different things. Full disclosure, my first second language was German. But it was in a language classroom, and I was a very rebellious teenager. I hated being in any class, let alone the language classroom where I didn't understand anything that was happening.
Yeah.
So I have a very visceral reaction to that language, which is awful because we went to Germany last year on vacation, and I loved it. So I kind of thought, I need to revisit this because this could be a place we could live in the future. So I have to separate my teenage classroom angst.
No, but you are not who you are.
You're
not who you were.
But why is it so difficult?
So I was just thinking, for it to be able to express one message or one meaning, there are Mandarin and English, and then you have to learn German equivalency. Wouldn't that get really confused? It is a little confusing, I think. It might be.
Yeah. What I've heard happening is that as you're learning it, if you need to say something like very quickly, one of your other languages that you know well might come out first.
Yes. That's why you see the Chinese today, they mix their language with English because the English comes out faster. Yeah,
that's wild to me. I look forward to the day when that happens to me.
Oh, that will. That definitely will happen
to me. It happens to me sometimes when I'm trying to say something very quickly in Chinese. Some Spanish will come out because I did learn a little bit of Spanish.
Nice.
In university, I suppose, and a little bit in Latin America while traveling. But when I say a little bit, I mean a little bit.
Yeah, but still, that's how your brain's wired.
Yeah, and I learned that trying to get around, take taxis, order things, talk to people, flirt, date, that kind of thing. So, I had practical language there.
The latter two is more interesting.
I know, right? Well, I don't need that anymore, per se, but it was very functional language. And what I'm learning basically the HSK stuff now, which isn't necessarily functional language.
That's not.
So when I'm out in public and I hear something and I understand it and I want to reply, Spanish or English comes out first. And I'm like, that's not helpful right now.
That's how it's connected.
Yeah. It's very strange. The first time it happened, I just kind of laughed, but I can't even follow up with that in Spanish. That's how low my level was there. So I'm like, well, that's two dead ends right next to each other. So how long do you need to study it for, and how high a level do you need to get in German?
I believe that the exam in German is pretty much in writing.
Okay.
So for rudimentary levels, there are two large books, literally two thick books. But other than that, most of them is in writing. They don't really expect the students on my level to be that fluent in German. So I think it's just elementary levels where you maybe master 1,000, maybe 1,500 words in German, and some basic grammar. So you could carry out day-to-day conversations and be done with it. Anything more than that would require more than 2 years of study.
Yeah, for sure. Do you have plans on how you're going to learn it?
Well, the school that I enrolled in is not the university, but a third-party sort of agency. We're supposed to offer us training mm-hmm. in German classes on a weekly basis, mm-hmm. but they failed because there are insufficient number of students.
Oh, no.
For me, I am not a big fan. I like to study at my own pace, mm-hmm. so this kind of one-on-one session is always better for me. Mm-hmm. So I actually found a British guy who works in Shanghai, mm-hmm. Who stayed in Germany for 4 years and mm-hmm. speaks fluent German.
Nice.
And then he needs to learn Mandarin.
There you go, so language exchange.
Exactly. So, start from maybe early of October, mm-hmm. then we'll start a weekly exchange.
Perfect.
But, you know, I'm in the market mm-hmm. for looking for a German mm-hmm. native speaker mm-hmm. because I can't really verify. Mm. I mean, he's a German learner, so mm-hmm. maybe he could teach me a lot of experiences mm-hmm. he accumulated in learning that mm-hmm. language. But pronunciation-wise, mm-hmm. I'm a little bit of a stickler for mm-hmm. pronunciation, so I would prefer mm-hmm. maybe a native German mm-hmm. speaker to do the exchange with me, and I live in downtown. He isn't, so it's going to be a little bit of trouble for him. So if audience, anyone who's mm-hmm. living in Shanghai, who's a native German speaker, who wants to learn Mandarin, please do reach out.
There you go. You heard it, listeners. Let us know. You can also have online ones, but since Shanghai's so diverse, you don't really need to go into the...
Online classes is only good when it's raining and you don't feel like going out.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you could have somebody online you could have somebody in Germany that you're talking to on a weekly basis, but because there's so many people from so many different places in Shanghai,
exactly.
it doesn't feel like you need to do.
I would always prefer face-to-face.
Yeah, definitely.
And besides, there are 6 or 7 hour time difference.
Oh, yeah, that.
Yeah, and I travel often.
Mm.
The internet connection, I would say, is not always optimal in some of the tier 2 cities.
Agreed. I experienced that pain last year.
Exactly. VPN is not the point anymore.
Oh, my gosh. Trying to upload YouTube videos at like 6 in the morning because at night too many people were using the thing. 5-star hotels. We skipped over the English stuff way too quickly, I think.
Maybe. All right.
Because we went from...
Do you want to revisit some of it?
Yeah. Because we went from the class that was horrible to the book that was wonderful.
Yeah.
So was it just reading then that kept you going in English and got you to a high level? Like,
well, reading alone opens the door for someone to truly understand mm-hmm. English as mm-hmm. a language. Mm. But without the foundation of literally memorizing vocabularies, mm-hmm. understand... going through a lot of reference books, mm-hmm. asking around when you have a question, have mm-hmm. some of these questions answered, and most important of all, daily practice, you'll never get nowhere.
Yeah. So who were your go-to people? Were there teachers or people around you, family members? Like us?
In high school, I was lucky enough mm-hmm. to actually work part-time mm-hmm. for a European company mm-hmm. and work closely with engineers. They're from mm-hmm. all over the world.
Yeah.
So they are, I would say, my troop of teachers, and they taught me so much. But nice. Mostly it's because I always ask questions, mm-hmm. and I'm just happy that the questions that my parents can't answer, they can, or at least they try to.
Right.
At that time, the internet is popular, but not on most of the English websites mm-hmm. and stuff. They're mm-hmm. still too difficult for me.
Yeah.
So that, I think I kept a habit of asking questions without emotions, like mm-hmm. if I ask a question, it's because I truly want to know, not mm-hmm. because I'm prying into anything. So
sure. Yeah.
I start to have all sorts of conversations,
sure.
topics with people, and that's also what got me into being an interpreter. Because mm-hmm. If you think about this profession, it's unique in a way that a dialogue, or so much information, is exchanging between two parties mm-hmm. or even three parties, mm-hmm. and then the interpreter is the third or the fourth mm-hmm. party that is not engaged mm-hmm. in the information exchange mm-hmm. at all, mm-hmm. but is somehow facilitating it. So I have the best job in the world because I get paid to learn,
mm-hmm.
and often from the best.
That's true. How do you juggle both languages at the same time, though?
I thought it would be a struggle, but no, it isn't.
Mm.
And I, with a lot of practice, I'm not kidding, a lot of practice, you can literally switch from one language to another seamlessly. And that's what we do on job site all the time, sometimes from one sentence to another. It has happened that sometimes I don't realize which language I'm speaking in.
That's so cool.
That's now amazing. Now I look at you,
yeah,
and you're Caucasian, I'm Asian, then I don't know, maybe subconsciously I talk to it in English, but I could be thinking in Mandarin right now,
right.
And a couple of minutes ago I was,
yeah.
And then I switched.
Yeah.
And sometimes I dream in English, which is really bizarre, because you didn't even realize, I didn't even, like, for you, dreaming in English is normal, but my mother tongue is Mandarin, so dreaming in English kind of scares me a little, because it's so weird. I didn't realize I was dreaming, because I had a whole conversation in my dream at age of, I think, 18 or 19, I think that's where the click. That's the switch off, and I scared myself a little the next morning when I realized I was dreaming in English instead of Mandarin, because it never happened before.
Yeah,
but then it happened a couple of times and you kind of get used to it afterwards. It did happen just about 6 months ago, and I was doing a consecutive interpretation between two parties, and I was hired by the foreign party to negotiate against the Chinese party. And the Chinese party understood a fairly good amount of English, but not proficient enough. So when she tried to said something in Mandarin, and then I was supposed to translate into English to my client, and I just said it, repeated literally, summarized and repeated in Mandarin without realizing it. My client was nice and polite enough not to interrupt me, so I went on for like 5 minutes.
So how did you know what you were doing?
When did it hit you? I realized I thought I was translating English the whole time when I was talking in Chinese. As soon as I started speaking, everybody looked at me, but I'm accustomed to it, because I'm consecutive interpretation. When you start talking, people always look at the interpreters, which they shouldn't, but they do anyways. So I said, you know, I just kept it going. And like 4 minutes later, when I'm finished, now my client said, "Can you repeat that in English?" I literally said to my client, like, "Didn't I just do that?" Then everybody looked at me and they realized that I was talking in Mandarin, and I thought I was talking in English.
Oh my God.
Because those two languages are such a blur to me.
Right. Do they feel different? Do they taste different? I've heard people say different languages feel like different colors or something.
Not that advanced.
But is there any difference?
That's like a mixed firing system in the, like, a brain.
Right? Yeah.
No, I would love to have that, but no.
Do you feel differently when you're speaking the different languages at all?
You know that the hit film, Arrival?
Yes, the alien film.
It actually discussed a very interesting linguistic phenomenon. That when you learn a foreign language, you build different pathways within your brain. And more pathways building, it cultivates the brain, it trains the brain to think differently. So you adapt to a different way of thinking. And I found that to be true, because English in its structure is very logical. And it's very fully structured. And, of course, besides poem and stuff, you have to ponder on that. Most of the daily use English is very structured and very logical and lenient in a way. That it's extremely predictable. Its structure is predictable. So when you learn that language and you learn it well, and you start to think that way as well, and it changes how you think, and you can spot the difference very clearly between Chinese young children and foreign kids. Foreign kids are more direct, or young Chinese kids, they are all over the place. Their thoughts and behaviors are all over the place. So I feel bad for the kindergarten teachers, because there's a bunch of unruly kids to rule over. But if the other way, like, you're a foreigner and you're learning Mandarin, and then I suppose that you would adopt to a more, I'd say, three-dimensional way of thinking, you would have associations made with specific words, because that's how the Chinese language is structured. A word is like a stem cell that connects in a three-dimensional way, that connects to multiple words, and they mutate into different meaning. In English, I'd say the words could do that, but not the sentence. The sentence is more logical, more linear. And in Mandarin, the sentence can also be extremely mutable.
Yeah.
They can be segmented, placed into different places, and then sometimes the meaning changes, sometimes it doesn't. Depends on the context. And that's what makes Mandarin super hard to learn. And in a way, once you learn it, the way that you think changes as
well. Yeah.
I have a new YouTube channel called Tube to Pod, and what I want to do in this channel is have micro videos of people answering three questions about podcasts. My goal for this channel is to bridge people from YouTube over to podcasts, not to replace their YouTube viewing, but to supplement it with podcasts. A lot of people apparently still are not listening to podcasts, still are unaware of what they are, what they can do with them, what they can learn from them, that kind of thing. So the three questions are, one, where do you listen to podcasts? Two, why do you listen to podcasts? And three, what is your favorite podcast at the moment? Now, if you're interested in participating in this, you can either post a video under 2 minutes on Instagram with the hashtag TubeToPod, TubeToPod, or you can email me your video and I'll post it on the YouTube channel. If you put it on Instagram, I'll record it, copy it over onto the channel. If you send it to me via email, I'll post it over onto the channel. And if you are more tech savvy than clearly I am, and you know a better way how to get other people's videos onto YouTube, please let me know, because right now I'm doing a copy and paste kind of thing. So I really look forward to your participation in that. Again, it's under 2 minutes, it's three questions, it's super easy. I want to expose people on YouTube to another audio experience that I think they would really, really enjoy, to spread the joy of podcasts. I think there's a lot of specific niche content out there that can teach us a lot about the world and a lot about the things we're already interested in moments of the day when we're not doing anything else with our brain. So yeah, it's a push to people to learn more about the things that they are already interested in, or learn about things that they don't even know exist yet. Anyway, Tube to Pod. I'll also put the link to the new channel in the show notes.
There's like 6 HSK levels. I'm using them just mostly to get a lot of vocabulary in,
right?
Because I want to read, and I think reading is when I'm going to start noticing the structures and get more familiar with how the words are used. So I'm getting a lot of vocabulary exposure at first. Finished 2 of 3. The third one's in December. The test. Coming from English, I'm very verb focused, and I taught English language for a number of years too, and I taught Chinese students for a number of years, and I noticed that they'd always forget to inflect their verbs. And I'm not mean, I don't red pen, I'm just like, look, meaning's being lost. The time in English, the time's really important in a verb, so we've got to start working on those. Forget everything else your other teachers used to mark, we need to work on those first, that's really, really important. So I know, as I'm learning Chinese, I know I'm putting too much emphasis on trying to understand where the verbs are, what the verbs are. Wait, why are the verbs so slippery? So many different things, but that's a verb. What's happening to my verbs? And I know I'm doing that coming from English, and I know that it's not going to be as rigid as a verb in English, even though verbs can do other things sometimes. In English, it's not as confined.
In Mandarin, there is very strict temporal tense in the sentence. There is past, present, future, but
it's not in that one word.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You could add words or subtract word or remove its location to indicate time. Mm-hmm. It is not the change of the word itself.
Right.
And so that's make it interesting.
Exactly. Because I feel like I'm going on a word search to find where the time is. When I'm like, I thought I hated verb inflections because I think using time words makes more sense.
Mm-hmm.
At least I did until I started to learn how to not use the language that didn't use them. Or that did use them. And so now I'm kind of like doing a word. That's the first time I'm saying this out loud. This is funny. Because I know I'm putting an overemphasis on that one word.
Right.
Or even just, the phrasal verb. I'm like, where is it? Where is the time? Where is it? No, it's got to be somewhere else. And I'm looking around the sentence. And even if I'm studying, I'm looking at the grammar explanation. And then I see it in a sentence.
You'll find the pattern.
Going the opposite direction. When you were learning English, did you have any moments like that where you knew you were bringing over something you learned in Mandarin into English and it wasn't making sense?
Nope. A lot of the Chinese students find it confusing, but I've always found it so clear because English grammar has strict rules to follow, meaning that literally these sentences and their variations can't get out of the framework.
There's so many exceptions.
There are exceptions, but there are even rules to exceptions, right? And they're not really exceptions. I mean, they're just a bunch of exceptions that follows a different rule, but it's not written into the rule book. That's what they are.
So verbs are very important in English. What's really important in Mandarin Chinese?
It depends on how you look at it and how you use it individually. If you're using
what's really important?
For me, I trust the Mandarin. For me, the most important part is to get the message across loud and clear without any misunderstanding, to be understood and to understand others' intentions. Mm-hmm. And it's not always easy.
Why?
Because when people think and talk in Mandarin, the language is flexible. And the worst part of Mandarin is that a lot of the information goes unsaid. It's between lines. So to decipher them is extremely difficult. I constantly have to verify, even with my parents. With Mandarin, you can say 10 things in 10 sentences. And 10 of these things, 10 messages aren't with no correlation whatsoever. But when it's being said in different sequence, it triggers different response or misinterpretations. And that's what Chinese people do often. Because when they communicate with another Chinese person, there is a preconception that you know what I'm talking about, so I can skip that part. Sure. But no, I don't know. That's the difficult part.
Is part of that, like, formality, or because there's different ways you can say stuff in English too. Like, you can say give me that, or can I have that, would you mind if you pass that? I mean, there's different. Is there any of that?
Yeah, you're talking about pronouns, and you can say that pronouns, but when you say can you pass that, I'll do this for me, and that and this and all that pronouns, it literally represents a very specific thing that you already sort of agreed on between two parties, right. You know.
Okay.
So there's a lot less misunderstanding.
Okay.
But in Mandarin, it could be 10 different things that particular word represents.
Right.
And often you don't even see the word in the sentence.
Right, because it's being spoken.
Yeah. And my mom does that all the time.
Yeah.
With Chinese female, it's amazing. Sorry, the guys are...
Yeah,
pretty much like straightforward in a way of thinking. Maybe they were born this way or somehow, but when they talk, there is less missed bits in the words. But when you talk with female, literally they can talk about 5 different things in 4 different sentences.
Huh.
Or in the same conversation, and it makes it so difficult to understand.
Oh, I want
so to I constantly request, like, do you mean that? Do you mean this? I think it's necessary advice. It's so much misunderstanding.
Can you think of any examples of that?
A couple of days ago, a client booked me on 2 different occasions. So these 2 different occasions are, there are 2 different industries involved together with documentations, agenda, location, all of this needs to be confirmed. And then so she mentioned the 2 different dates and asked me if I was available. My answer was, yes, I'm available on both dates, right? And then, good. And then she starts sending me documentations and locations without specifying which was which. And that is, I wouldn't say typical Chinese behavior, but this is very typical in the language to go amiss. Because for her, it's perceived that I understood which was which material uses on which dates. And then I try to figure it out without alarming her, so I open all the documents and there was no dates on them. I felt like I looked really foolish in Chinese culture to reconfirm the dates and the material that goes with it.
Right.
I think that's why Chinese find it really difficult to apologize or to admit their mistakes, because there are so much content that just went missing in the conversation when you're talking Mandarin. It's very easy to go missing.
Things that I can relate to it now are the constant verification with Didi drivers. Regardless of a pin on a specific spot. Are you there? Are you definitely there? Are you right there? They'll arrive, you're shaking your phone, that you open the door, and they say, is it this? Yes. Are you going here? Yes. And they'll ask, like, 2 times during the ride, and I'll be like, yeah, where is it?
They
is
just
that?
Want to make sure you understand.
And I feel like, even in the brief conversations that I have in cafes, or if I'm buying something somewhere, which is unfortunately the only transactions I can do because they're very short right now, I feel like there's extra questions with the same information. Is that possibly from part of what you're talking about? Is the confirming?
That's because you're a foreigner. With Chinese, there will be less confirmation needed. But the confirmation here is different from a general conversation because you're going through a transaction to make sure that you know your end of the deal. Just to make sure that you don't fire a complaint against them later. And that's the purpose for this multiple times of confirmation. But in the general Chinese conversation, often that you can see a lot of the content in the conversation is missing, and it's difficult to grasp, and that poses a very big trouble for me because I'm constantly wondering, like, okay, what's this and what's that? Especially in Mandarin literacy, there are so many things that's just not there. Like, why can't it just be there? Why can't you just make it clear to me? It drives me crazy when you don't complete the sentence.
Are there writers that are more explicit in their meanings? Are any of those popular? Or just in existence, not even popular, but...
There must be, but most of the Chinese literacy, when I read, it's just, I think most of the time, this literacy, these articles literally just recorded a very simple story.
Mm-hmm.
I go to the park, I saw the flowers, I loved it. The end.
Mm.
But just the way that it was written and it was interpreted into so many different ways, like, why is that necessary? But I don't think it's a very Chinese thing to do. Mm. I think it happens in the entire literacy world is to understand what the mood the author was going through, what happened to his or her life at that time that encouraged the book. Come on, a story is a story. Enjoy it. That's why I like science fiction, because there are not so many historic things behind it. You could enjoy it as a story as it is.
Oh, I cannot agree with you more. I grew up loving reading, and so I thought, oh, natural. I'll just go into studying English literature in university.
Right.
And my first literature class, I walked out of. I was like, what are you doing to this wonderful story? you're going to make it some better. I was like, you're killing. I literally walked out of class. And I was like, nope. We're going to go general something until I finally moved over to science for a little while. Because I was like, no, you're killing it. You're killing these beautiful stories. You're doing it too much.
Yeah.
It's one thing if something means this to me as I'm reading it. But to go, this is the way we should read it, or this is the agreed upon translation or interpretation, or let's all just sit around and talk about our interpretations for a while. I'm like, doesn't move anything forward.
Exactly.
It's one thing to share stories, but I don't know. For some reason, it just, I couldn't stand it.
One of the greatest work ever written, which I actually absolutely love, is the story of the Red Mansion.
Okay.
The story is one of the four most famous literacy ever written, out of four. Cao Xueqing, The Dream of the Red Mansion.
Mm-hmm.
That's the official English name of the title translation, but the original name is actually called The Legend of Shi Tou Ji, everything. The story of stones.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make any sense, but it told a fictional story of an aristocratic family, a huge family, and its fall. It's very similar to some of the English literature, but it featured 88 characters.
Whoa!
88 characters. Each character is portrayed in a way that it's so distinctive that each character, they have done the tally, that each character had no more than 30 or maybe 40 words featured in this artwork.
Yeah.
And each one of them, you can memorize them so vividly. They jump out of it.
What was that? Like,
they are
Chaucer's...
alive. You can't deny their existence. They are real, so real to you.
Yeah.
And each one of them is so unique to you.
Yeah.
And somehow that it's so fitting. And in their interactions, you see the beauty and the ugliness of human nature.
That is beautiful.
Absolutely. That's something worth a read. And there are a lot of study groups or scholars try to interpret deeper into the meaning.
Mm.
I don't think it's necessary.
Yeah. It's all just right there.
When you read, there is one story that I remember vividly, that all of these, what we say, ladies from respective families, right? They are very talented and they're very well taught, very civilized. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep.
Very respectful to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So often that what they do is that in the mid-afternoon, after lunch, they would gather in a garden and they would drink tea, play chess, play instruments, write poems.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, lots of beautiful poems written in there. Absolutely beautiful. But there are still what we saw, mortals, regular human beings. So one day they had a visitor. The visitor is supposed to be really high and aloof, kind of out of the world, because she's a nun.
Mm-hmm.
So she studies Buddhism all the time, nun, and then she's very well respected. She was invited to the family to conduct some kind of religious ritual, and when it's done, she joined them, these young girls. Actually, most of them are age 15 or 16, right? Okay. So they're full of vigor, creativity, and all that. They're having fun. And then there is a cup of jade teacups, mm-hmm. very, very small, but exquisite, because mm-hmm. they're rich. So it's very small, yeah. exquisite. So at that very afternoon, one of the distant relative who has fallen and who's in the rural area is pretty much just a farmer. Mm. So this old lady came to visit one of the girls. Mm-hmm. One of the girls, it's a distant relative, mm-hmm. but they're so poor that when this old lady came into this beautiful courtyard, and she was absolutely stumped. Mm-hmm. So there is a series of descriptions saying how out of place she felt. Mm-hmm. And then there was this drastic difference of class mm-hmm. that she felt, she sensed. And then she awkwardly sat beside them, and she was feeling, this is not my thing, but mm-hmm. she was being very kind of greeting everybody. Mm-hmm. Everybody was greeting her back. And then it was the tea serving time. Mm-hmm. So the green tea was being brewed and poured. Mm-hmm. And then she didn't know which cup, because there are quite a few cups already lying around on mm-hmm. the table. So she picked up the cup, the jade cup, mm-hmm. and then start tasting the tea, because mm-hmm. she has traveled afar and nobody has really offered her any drinks. So right. she had several, and she made a fool of herself.
Oh, yeah.
She made a fool of herself. Sure. And at the end, the nun offered the jade cup mm-hmm. to the old lady mm-hmm. as a gift of her visit. That represents a small fortune for yeah. someone who's coming from such a poor family.
Yeah,
so she was really moved. And the jade cup was, they used this kind of silk handkerchief. Mm-hmm. So the handkerchief wrapped around and they gave it to her.
Wow.
So you think superficially that's a great deed, right? Mm-hmm. But the truth is, the reason that this jade cup was offered to her as a gift is because the nun thinks that a peasant has drank it and it's dirty and it can never be washed clean. And then she's not supposed to think that as a nun.
Right. Is it the nun that offered her the...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There is always two sides to the story.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of reading these stories. That's... There are so many layers to peel over.
Is this available in many languages?
Yes. And the English translation is very, very good.
It is good. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool, very good. I wonder if there's a bilingual edition.
There isn't.
I'm going to have to go to the bookstore. Damn it.
Because there are just so many, many chapters. Mm. The bilingual edition will be this much.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
But it will be a very interesting read mm-hmm. for you guys to read an English one and mm-hmm. then for me to read a Mandarin one mm-hmm. and then we can meet up and discuss.
Sold.
That will be so cool.
That would be really, really cool. I'm so game for that. One of the book groups I'm in, actually, they only do books. I always forget if it's just based around Shanghai or based around China. They're the book group that I read the Remembering Shanghai. Did I get that name right? Yeah, I read that one for them. I wonder if they would be interested in doing that too. We could get a bunch of people around to talk about it, maybe.
Yeah. It would be a really interesting discussion.
It would be. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Okay, we're going to have to plan after this. I love how into storytelling and stories you are. It's so fascinating. And the way that you tell stories is really captivating.
I love reading stories, and I love some of the stories, mm-hmm. the way that they're being told is absolutely captivating.
It really is. And I'll tell you what, I've had some eye issues over the past few years, and it's something I've talked about in the podcast before, and so I actually stopped reading, like, paper books for a while, because I get really bad headaches, and it just doesn't feel good. So I switched over to as much audio as I could, and then for books that I couldn't find in audio form, I just was like, I guess I'm not reading those for now. And I've been able to read a few in paper form lately, and it's challenging. I have to, like, do, like, an hour and then walk away and I'm done for the day. Like, I can't sit in a corner and read for hours anymore, but I can do it occasionally. So that's reopened back up, and there's a lot more in audio now, so it's a good time to have eye problems.
Okay, then I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you feel differently when you, let's say that you read the same book, mm-hmm. on paper mm-hmm. and versus audio, right?
Yeah. And depending on the book and the narrator, it could vary. Like Harry Potter, I went through the entire series in audio, and I'm really glad that I did, because I could just close my eyes and see it.
Me too.
And not worry about the words. And I don't like her writing style for the first book, I didn't like that. I thought it was very immature and it didn't really appeal to me, so I'm glad that I could go into the story.
Yeah.
And not worry about it. So it really, really depends on the book and the narrator.
And I did a whole audiobook for Twilight because I don't think it's worth the read.
I actually just did the movies and I was really surprised that I got into the movies. I don't think I've ever admitted that out loud before.
Oh, I can tell you, the audiobook, the writing is absolutely idiotic.
Yeah. Well, the story is really ridiculous.
Bloody junior English level, like high school English level.
Yeah.
Same that goes with the shortest book I've ever read with 50 Shades of Grey. Why am I reading this? This is so boring. Why am I reading this? Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And then it's about an hour, it's done.
I kept waiting for the good parts that why everybody was...
It never happened.
Yeah. Like, what? And the movie was even worse. Like, why am I doing this stuff? What is happening? And I'll do audio and fiction, nonfiction. I'll do podcasts. I'll do, like, lectures and all that kind of stuff. One of my favorite creative people is Elizabeth Gilbert. She wrote the book Eat, Pray, Love, which is not, by any stretch, one of my favorite books. It's not. It's an interesting story. It took people's imagination and did something with it. But when she talks about creativity, I think she's on fire. Hmm. It's amazing. Like, have you seen her TED Talk on creativity?
No, I haven't.
I'm going to send it to you. It's truly, it's like 15 minutes that will make you think for like 15 hours.
Ooh.
It's really, really good. And then she wrote this book called Big Magic, which is mostly matter-of-factly, but chapter 5 is life-changing. She describes how to let creativity go. Not to claim it, not to possess it, how to kind of just coexist with it, and it kind of lets it flourish more if you stop trying to possess it. And it's this really,
that makes sense.
Really cool way of looking at it. And it's just, it was like, whoa, that's crazy.
Does that sound a little similar like theater activity that you would often enjoy?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can. We're not... Are you speaking about a very sensual activity?
Indeed. Now we're on the same page.
We're not censored yet. Maybe season 3. Yeah, no. Oh, gosh, you're so right. I'm going to think about that for a minute. Listeners, let us know what you think about that analogy. Now, you already answered the dream question, so we're not going to do that.
Oh, you have a question about dreams?
Yeah! The one of the women I was talking about earlier, who grew up in Songjiang,
right.
she wanted to know in future interviews what languages people dream in, but you've already answered that.
But I think apart from the language that you're dreaming, my dream, I would say, is quite unique because it's always a complete story and it's always adventurous story.
Whoa.
It's always a bit of a life-threatening, but not really being killed, very, very adventurous story.
And the story always has the completion. Like, it's not, you never wake up before the story's over. What?
Yeah, but half of the story, I'm literally directing, rewriting it the whole time when it's happening. So it's awesome.
Okay, I was meaning to ask you this earlier. Do you write?
No, I don't.
How is that possible?
Because it's so awful. My writing is not good. I try.
No! Okay, but, I mean,
I need to take writing
You've
got to
do some sort of storytelling. Because if you're editing your dream, if you're, like, directing your good dreams and doing that, and you've got the power of storytelling behind you, you're wasting your talent.
Thank you. Now I know that what I can do for the rest of my life when I retire.
Awesome.
I think it would be really awesome to write some of the stories and the conversations, people's opinions.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that drives me to do what I do today is because I realize people are so diversified. Each one of them are absolutely unique in his or her own way, or she own way.
Yeah.
And in a way that it's so unique the way that they think, so the way that they express themselves are different. And for me, I drive tremendous joy from listening to people from all over the world and then try to interpret and try to match their speech style, not just to deliver what they're saying, but to actually match their style. It's a challenge, but it's so much fun.
That sounds so difficult. So
in one of those market research, often that the moderator is talking with 6 or more people to conduct the research. And it's a Q&A style. Like, the moderator would ask questions like you're asking me now, and the respondent will respond. But each one of them, they all come in different background, mm-hmm. maybe they have similar interests or so,
mm-hmm.
but each one, when they talk, they all use different style.
Mm-hmm.
So my ultimate goal in conducting or translating this kind of market research is that without looking at the audio, because mm-hmm. the session is being audio and video recorded mm-hmm. all the time
mm-hmm.
for research purposes, but my ultimate goal is that if you listen to my translation, mm-hmm. I hope that you could distinguish each respondent by my different choice of words, and that would be so awesome.
So I can tell why you're not writing now, because all of your creativity is going into that masterpiece. Yeah, no, seriously, that's a lot of mental energy to be able to recreate the person, not just the words.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and the best of all is that when the when my audience is looking at the things mm-hmm. happening, but they're not hearing anything mm-hmm. in the original context, mm-hmm. and sometimes when they make a joke,
mm-hmm.
it's not really funny translating to a different language.
Yeah, so it
really takes wits in the split of a second to be able to translate that.
Right.
And then you see people who is listening to the original Mandarin mm-hmm. conversation, mm-hmm. they laugh, and then half seconds later, the foreigners start laughing too.
Okay, that's a good point. What would you say is the biggest difference between the humor in Mandarin Chinese and in English?
I would say that some of the, like, the points of humor, right, mm. are absolutely universal.
Mm.
But some of the words are so embedded in culture, mm-hmm. like puns, that just some of the things is not possible to translate. Yeah, like I try to translate do the subtitle translation for a lot of comedy, like the Big Bang Theory, and also the Two Broke Girls
yeah.
and all that.
Sure.
Like a practice, because I don't get paid for it.
Okay.
But some of the puns are so difficult to translate. This is where your capabilities are.
Yeah.
You have to be so creative.
Oh,
and there are some yeah. subtitle translators that are mm-hmm. absolutely amazing. They get me floored all the time.
I often wonder about Big Bang, because when we were in China 8 years ago, we left for about 8 years, our 19, 20-year-old students were really into the Big Bang Theory.
I am so addicted.
But I like the show. I'm watching it, and it's in its final season, apparently. But I watch it, and I think, words, yes, but there's so many cultural references, like
yeah.
so many, that I have to sometimes think, I get it. Or I'll be like, if it's something really new and I've been out of the country for a while, I'll have to kind of Google it and go,
yeah.
oh, that's what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So I'm like, how do they get those cultural references?
Research.
Fair enough.
I think, for translator, research mm-hmm. is a huge part of my job. It takes more time than mm-hmm. actual work.
Mm-hmm.
But for the audience who is watching at these comedies, they either get it or they don't get mm-hmm. it. If they're really interested, they might dig into that.
Sure.
But it's a personal choice. But
it's very popular in China. The Big Bang Theory.
I Keeping Up with the Kardashians is probably more popular amongst the millennials. Oh, no.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm sorry to the fans that like it, but to the audience that likes it, but...
I know, it's the kind of lifestyle that the millennial generation
yeah.
is really into it, but sorry, I'm a little bit older than that, and I appreciate a higher league of fun.
It was just so slow. I tried to watch one episode because I was very curious what people were intrigued with, and I almost fell asleep. I was like, nothing's happening.
Exactly. But sometimes these millennial people, when these things happen, and they would feel like, oh, you know what, I'm living my life, they're living our life, their life too, at the same time, and I feel like I'm right next to them.
Mm.
I understand that kind of,
okay.
I would say companionship.
Sure, sure.
But in life, in real life, a lot of the times, mm-hmm. most people live with lots of disposable mm-hmm. hours to spend, and they're bored.
Mm-hmm. They must be, because it's one of the slowest things I've ever watched in my life.
I didn't even bother with it.
I think I lasted like 15 minutes. It was bad. It was bad. I don't know. It's not like I didn't watch stupid stuff when I was their age. Of course I did. I watched MTV mostly from like my teenagehood until, I don't know, early 20s?
I still watch MTV.
Well, I don't because they stopped playing music.
Well,
like it was
okay,
a mixture
yeah.
of programs and music,
exactly.
and then it just the music went away, and I'm like,
yeah.
ah,
it's less and less now. It's,
yeah,
it's more about getting advertisements and getting paid. But
yeah.
in the past, there are some decent music.
Yeah, and there were some decent shows. Like
yeah.
The Real World was funny in the first few seasons. I think it's still going.
Oh my
Is the
god,
Real World still
really?
Going? I think it's like 20 episode no, season
oh
20
god.
Or something. I'm like, okay, I think we've played all that out. I think we're good. I don't know. I don't know.
But in comparison, I would much prefer British episodes because it's short and it's compact. Mm. Especially Downton Abbey. Mm. Oh my God, the translation. Oh,
really?
I mean, when you listen to it, it's really not much. Just the way they talk. But when you write down the translations, there's so much to learn from. And it's so proper English.
Mm-hmm.
Julian, the writer, actually won the best writing for Emmy.
Mm.
Right, best writer.
Yeah.
Absolutely gorgeous. And then in the way that they delivered these lines, you know that their emotion tumbling beneath the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so
behind.
Enjoyable.
You can't see it, but it's
right
it.
It's
here
so
behind
British.
Her.
You can feel it's like tumbling down.
Did
That's
you ever see
acting.
The movie Remains of the Day? Super old movie now.
No, I don't think I have. What's the story?
Emma Thompson, well, the main actors were Emma Thompson and Anthony Hopkins. Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they were two servants in this super proper British household. Many, many years ago. And they apparently had a thing for each other. They were very fond of each other.
Aww.
But nothing ever came of it because they were just trying to play their role in the house. So it was just a series of them not telling each other how they felt about each other. Like, they were always around each other and always being overly formal, but always be like, but you'd never see that. But you could kind of tell it was there. And the whole movie was them not doing anything. And I was sitting there just like, I'm a lot more patient now. But then I was like, come on, let's go. Do something, say something. You don't have to do it in public. Just, like, slip them a beautiful poem or just do something.
Handkerchief.
Yeah.
Drop it.
But they never, I don't remember the ending, to be honest with you, but I'm pretty sure nothing ever happened.
Aww.
But the whole movie was just kind of that repressed fondness. Yeah, exactly. But...
Oh, now I have to watch it.
Two of my favorite actors of all time, and I was just like, why did you do this to me?
Yeah, but that's the whole joy.
I know.
It doesn't necessarily have to be, like, super happy endings, but...
No, but...
It's just the charisma.
I wanted them to have one moment of acknowledgement that they both felt the same way. I wanted them to know.
Yeah, but wouldn't that be a lot less torturous for the audience?
Yes, but it could just be at the end.
Oh, come on.
For the last... Like, just have them, like, brush hands for, the, like, the last second. And then they're done, or something.
You want the last second of release.
I do. I want them to... I want those characters to know that they were loved. Instead of just being lonely people, just fulfilling their, you know, their servantial... Duties? Is that even a word?
Oh, you that's know? A very good word if it wasn't there.
It should be a word.
Oh, I totally feel with you.
Yeah, I wanted them to know that.
I think it reminded me of one of the... I don't even remember the name of the movie, but it was because of World War II. Then the boy and the girl were separate. They love each other, but they didn't express that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the boy was on the way after the war to find a girl, and... He got some kind of injury and actually died the night before she was supposed to meet the girl. And that was after maybe 10, 12 years.
Right.
In the time span.
Mm.
And he thought the girl was alive.
Mm-hmm.
But actually the girl was actually killed 3 days after they departed. And it was absolutely gut-wrenching when I saw the story. And I think it's quite recent.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't remember the movie where it was in. I think I was the only one who was crying in the whole movie series.
Really?
I was crying the whole time.
I would be crying for that. I would definitely be crying. I think I'm much more of a people got together and knew they loved each other, and then things went horrible.
You see that the reality is the girl has died a few days after they've departed,
yeah.
But the boy...
But he doesn't know.
Didn't know. Oh. And is that sense of longing, that kind of gravitating towards her. And then... He didn't know that he was going to die that evening.
Mm.
He thought he just had a cold. And his troop mates, someone who came back with him, kept comforting him, knowing that, kept saying that, oh, you're going to see her tomorrow, you guys are blah, 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 right? And the truth is that he knew he wouldn't survive the night, and he didn't.
Did he because he didn't know she was dead, did he try to contact her that night?
They tried, but there was no communication
between
the two countries, so they've not contacted each other for many, many years.
So he died not knowing that she had already died years ago?
No. And he did not even realize that he was going to die that morning.
Right.
And the night before, his more experienced troopmate, already knew that he's not going to survive the night.
So how could people not be crying?
So he kept, he knew, and he was crying when he said to him, he was already pretty much like, he said, oh, you know what, I feel really tired.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to, you know, close my eyes for a little bit and try to catch an early bus or something. He said, yeah, sure, just relax and, you know, to build up your strength. You're going to meet your girl tomorrow. But he knew that he's not going to make it. And I was crying the whole time.
Yeah. But you were in a movie theater.
Nobody else
cried. And nobody else was crying. How is that possible?
I don't know.
They were lying. They went home and cried for hours.
Very possibly, yeah.
Convinced.
I just have very little self-control, so I just like...
No!
Forget it.
I love... After a good cry, I feel so light.
Absolutely,
yeah. So I'm like, no, if it happens, there you go.
Crying is like the best detox, one of the best detox.
Right? That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll intentionally watch a sad movie.
Oh, that's great. It's advised to do so.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Once in a while when you feel like all of these negative emotions build up
from
work or from whatever that makes you unhappy. If you build up, it's going to hurt your organs. And
I need to. It's like a cloud over my head and it's just kind of pushing me down. I'm like, I got to get rid of it.
That sad movie that's, you know, cries our eyes out and it feels so relaxed. And
so good. We must sound so weird right now. But I'm telling you, listeners, you got to try this.
No, this is very, very therapeutic.
Oh, yeah? Okay, so check it out. So on this podcast, we have both people learning Chinese, all stages, through, and people who grew up with Chinese and learning other languages. So what questions should I ask future guests?
Instead of saying question, I would say that why don't we invite the audience to share one of their most memorable experiences in language learning.
Mm-hmm.
Then we go from there. What do you think?
Yeah, let's do it.
It could be both for language learners of any kind.
Yeah. What do we want them to share? I like it. Let's do it.
We could let them share some, doesn't necessarily have to be awkward, but something that is unexpected, something that surprises them or even scared them a little.
Mm-hmm.
And then I always feel that when you're closely connected to these true emotions, and then this is where it sparks. This is where you feel that you're truly connected to a human being, disregard of the physical distance, because you can sympathize, you can relate to that emotion.
Mm-hmm.
So I would dare to say that the scariest moment that you've encountered in learning the language and living in that country, or it could be most touching moment.
Right.
It could be something that reaches deeply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something that you as a foreigner as a foreigner. I would say foreigner not because you're coming from another country, but because you're learning a foreign language.
Exactly. Yeah.
As a foreigner, language is foreign to you. You've realized that in your dealings with people who spoke a different language. Mm-hmm. Perhaps, you know, there are so many interesting things to share.
Absolutely. And those deep emotions connected to the language make it stronger and easier to retain the language, and it becomes real.
Always. Like, the memory is always much better constructed or memorized through emotions.
What should we have them tag it so we can follow this, and they can follow it?
Strong stories.
Yeah.
Into it.
So thank you so much, Liz, for coming today. This has been so intensely interesting. Seriously, no, I really appreciate this. When you dive into language, you dive into someone's soul in a way, right? You're going into their childhood and their emotions and their dreams and thoughts and
it's
literally
all interconnected.
Dreams. Yeah, it's all interconnected. So I really appreciate you sharing this with not just with me, but with our listeners.
Audience, I don't know who you are, but I hope that through this session of podcast, we bring each other a little bit closer.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Changing Scripts podcast. Again, if you are learning the Chinese language, or if you're coming from the Chinese language learning another language, I'd love to interview you for this podcast. Please feel free to contact me in any social media way that you see fit. Go ahead and contact me, and we will hash out how to get you on the sound creation known as the Changing Scripts podcast. A lot more is coming your way soon.